This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Down to Georgia, he was looking for a soul to steal. He was in a bind because he was way behind and he was willing to make a deal. When he came across this young man sawing on a fiddle and playing it hot, and the devil jumped up on a hickory stump and said, "Boy, let me tell you what.
Place to Be Nation listeners, welcome if you'd care to, take a dare, I'll to our luxurious studios in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. I am Greg Phillips. With me, as he is every week, is Nicholas Duke, the 14th. We are the hard-traveling fanboys. Welcome to another edition of the Longbook Hunters. We've been out on a safari hunting our prey, and we found it in the form of Kevin Smith's very first work in superhero comics, his 1998, 99, whatever it was, Marvel Knights run on Daredevil with Joe Quesada, the story arc titled Guardian Devil.
Jimmy Palmiotti.
Yes, on inks.
That's right.
And it kicked off a new era of Daredevil, a new volume of Daredevil, and a volume of Daredevil that proved to be very successful and to be just as creatively successful as some of the classic runs that seem to follow this character from era to era. It seems like Daredevil just can't go through a 10-year period without having awesome creators.
As we'll get into a little bit later, I haven't read much Daredevil, but I can't say that I've ever read a bad Daredevil story. Like,
yeah.
Not a single one in my life. So, you know, there's that. And you mentioned back from our safari, in addition to tracking down this epic run of comics, we also were able to locate a giraffe and a kangaroo that contain the reincarnated souls of George Washington and Smoking Joe Frazier, respectively. So it was quite a fruitful trip for the hard-traveling fanboys.
It was. We saw spot monkeys hanging from trees. We saw gardeners raking and digging ditches, or we hope were ditches. We saw any number of crazy things.
We even ran into esteemed legal expert Joseph Park,
who did give us a pretty good rate, I have to say. We don't really have any use for a legal expert right now, but, I mean, that rate was pretty hard to pass up.
Yeah, I mean, you always have to be on the lookout for copyright infringement of certain concepts that your podcast uses.
Which brings me to my first point of the day. On a recently released episode of Seller's Points, which you can also find, by the way, right here on Place to Be Nation. Pop, if you're not subscribed to it, what the hell's wrong with you? Do you not like comics? Do you not like other things besides comics that are occasionally mentioned on these shows? I mean, just subscribe.
Beer, for example. We have
beer.
We have, you know, top beer from the Lucha Undead people that drops.
That's right. Beer.
At least once a week. So if you like beer,
if you like TV shows, we've got Geek and Sassy now, and they're talking about all the different fandoms within the geek universe,
right?
Television, etc.,
right.
Comics included.
Right.
And of course, we've got the all encompassing Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular,
right?
Covering a variety of topics. We've got the comics world covered between Conversation Comics with Todd Weber. And, of course, that brings me to our compadre, some would say competition in this case, the Sellers Point Podcast with my dear close personal longtime friend Russell Sellers and that Mon-El fanboy, Kelly Poole.
Yes, if you hadn't heard the most recent episode of Sellers Points, they had, you know, some might say some unique comments about our esteemed Mr. Phillips, calling him, among such things as a Richard, a Dick Jones, and even a Clarence Boddicker.
Now, quite frankly, some might say that, oh, JR, why don't you respond to him? Why don't you sink down to their level and fire him? I say, folks, it doesn't do any good. You know, we're not going to do a parody version of the Sellers Point Podcast. We're not going to do that right now, folks. Quite frankly, I'd suggest that perhaps if certain certain individuals like to suggest certain comics to read about what will happen if a Kryptonian and a Daxamite fought each other. I'd say, well, what's that little story? A little story you might have heard of. It came out a few years ago. What's that story called, Nick? About the Sinestro and the Corps?
I don't know. Some kind of Sinestro, some sort of war involving the Sinestro Corps.
But
I seem to remember something about one of those prime characters.
Right.
Whooping that Daxamite arse, as it were.
Not only a Dax. Now, some might say that it wasn't just a Daxamite. Somebody say, well, he had a Green Lantern ring, too. A Daxamite with a Green Lantern ring still couldn't whoop that ass. So,
that's right. Yeah.
But that's not for me to say. Quite frankly, maybe Mon-El could whoop some Kryptonian ass. I don't know. All I know is it's not for me to say.
The important thing to remember about Mon-El is that, you know, everybody could whoop that ass. Batman, Superman, Aquaman. Yeah, Aquaman. Do the talks to the fishes. He'd whoop that ass just like that.
And he'll bring all his powers, too. X-ray vision. Heat vision, cable vision, all of them.
But no, you know, they certainly had some controversial things to say about my esteemed co-host. And, you know, like you said, Greg, we're not going to stoop to their level. We're above that. And so, actually, we're going to kill them with kindness. And right now, I'm gonna give you a little recommendation. They should actually use this as the ad clip for Seller's Points. So let me hit you with a little recommendation for Seller's Points. Here we go. Are you ready for this?
I'm ready.
If you love comic books and comic book podcasts and want to hear two guys talk about comic books, check out the Seller's Point podcast, featuring such outstandingly original weekly segments as Top 3, Bottom 1. I mean Top 2, Bottom 2. And The Rundown. Oh, wait a minute. I mean News Points. And also, this past week, they debuted a new recurring feature, Countdown. Oh, excuse me. It's the top five live-action comic book shows. So, yes, a beacon of originality here on the Place to Be Nation Pop Network. You know, I liken Seller's Points as to walking in after you've been out in the sun, after a hot day of, you know, intense physical labor, and going to your refrigerator, seeking some liquid refreshment, and you open your fridge and you pull out a nice ice-cold Diet Coke, and you take a great big swig of the Diet Coke, and you think to yourself, Diet Coke, just one calorie, not quite hard traveling enough, and then you move on about your day. And then, you know, you think about what someone like Clarence Boddicker might say to the individuals who host the Seller's Point podcast, and why don't we turn to our own, very own Clarence Boddicker to utter those immortal words.
Bitches leave.
There you go.
And now that we've got that little piece of business out of the way, I trust that there's no more controversy in the air. I trust that there's no more doubt in anybody's mind what would happen if Superman and Mon-El were to confront one another. There's no doubt about that. There's no doubt about what you're listening to right now, which is the longest running
weekly
episodic
comic book podcast in
Place to Be
Nation
pop history.
Woo!
Yes. Years of practice, boys. In any event, we're going to get cracking with our illustrious segment known the world over, as far away as New Zealand, which is a long way from British Columbia, as you all know. All the way in New Zealand, they know this segment. It's called What You Reading, What You Watching, and as has been the case throughout the last several weeks,
we're not watching anything. Nothing. Nope.
Nothing. The only things we're watching are pro wrestling and football right now.
That's right. So, amen, that's right.
Let's move on.
However, we should say that rapidly approaching are the season debuts of the DCCW shows that we will be watching each and every week. As is approaching the season premiere of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which one of us will not be watching every week, seeing as how one of us hasn't finished season two of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. yet.
And also the debut of Luke Cage approaches.
Oh, God. Oh, damn it.
And also the premiere of the Good Walking Dead show approaches.
Listen, I have not seen any episodes.
I haven't either.
Of season two of Fear of the Walking Dead. I will say, based on season one alone, I didn't think it was a great show, but it was not the train wreck I have heard that season two has turned into. anyway.
Right, right. No, I haven't watched. I only watched the first couple episodes of season two. I didn't think season one was horrible. I just thought it was boring until the last couple episodes, which picked it up. But I'm going to catch up, but I'm waiting for it to come on Netflix so I can catch up.
Right.
But yes, so all that's approaching, and we'll be getting into all that very soon. And we'll address one of those shows here in the near future on this very podcast. But first, what you're reading? Now, as you know, this week we're reviewing Kevin Smith's Guardian Devil, which I did through the Marvel Unlimited app, as did Nick.
The exquisite Marvel Unlimited app.
Indeed, indeed. However, this led to what some might consider to be an incident, because neither of us were aware at the time that we decided to review this book that it was 8 issues in length.
I had read it before, but I had forgotten that I thought it was 6 issues instead of 8. And as we will discuss in a little bit, this you could tell this was very much Kevin Smith's first comic work, because there are times where the sheer amount of word balloons and text boxes on the panel become overwhelming. So
yes, this is not a good idea to try to cram into one weekend or say 2 days.
Yes, this is not a quick and breezy read, you know.
Right. So, but anyway, because of that, I still, even though I have a massive, I'm looking at a massive stack of a month's worth of comics, and I still haven't read through most of them. I did, however, get a chance to read through enough to do a top 3. I will not have a bottom 1.
Now, wait just a minute. You just said you read 4 books, Greg. You told me that offline.
I did read three plus one is four.
You got to have a bottom 1.
I got to have a bottom 1, even if I liked it.
That's right. Amen.
All right,
that's right.
I'll have a bottom 1 then. Well, what do we
start?
Well,
let's start there. Give me your bottom 1.
My bottom 1. All right. Oh, this is hard to do, Nick, because I liked all 4 of these. If I had to pick a bottom 1, it would have to be Suicide Squad Rebirth number 1.
Okay. I believe this graced my bottom list at one point.
Yes, this was the Rebirth special. I, however, did like it much more than you did. I found the writing to be not great, but to be solid. I thought it was an introductory issue, introducing the team and to a new audience, presumably. I thought it did a very good job. I actually liked the usage of the current sitting president in it, because that's what DC did back in the 80s, which to a lot of people was DC's best decade. I would argue the 2000s era was probably the best, but you know, some would say the 80s. And they used Reagan back then to good effect, and I thought this was, you know, it didn't bother me, I'll put it that way. The writing wasn't amazing, but I thought it was entertaining, and I was intrigued enough to follow the book going forward into the number 1 issue, which I have but have not read yet. So, but that's my worst, because I will say the art I thought wasn't great in places. It was kind of inconsistent, and some of the dialogue was not bad, but just kind of blended
together.
On the
nose.
Yeah, on the nose and blended together. And very, very expository.
Yes.
Very expository. That was where, towards the end, there were some lines from Amanda Waller that were overly expository, in my opinion. So
I agree.
That's my bottom 1. What's yours?
I'm going to go with, and this is a huge surprise, I'm sure, but I'm going with Justice League number 4. it's time. It's time to just pull the plug once and for all. Nothing is impressing about this series. The art, no Tony Daniel on this issue, so it gets even worse. The story just isn't interesting. The dialogue has a tendency to shift between incredibly awkward and incredibly on the nose, and it just, I mean, there's nothing good about it at this point. And, you know, it feels like a book that doesn't really fit in with some of the tight continuity that Rebirth has had thus far, because in this book, they're treating it as if this is the first time the new Justice League, or the Justice League, has worked with the pre-New 52 Superman, whereas we have already seen him, you know, interact with Batman and Wonder Woman in the Superman title, and those events have been acknowledged throughout other titles and stuff. And so this feels like even a book that Hitch just has lost track of, and I think I'm done at this point. I'll probably come back for the Justice League Suicide Squad event in December, but for the next couple of months, I'm out, man. I can't do this anymore. Can't justify spending $6 a month on this quality.
Well, hard to blame you. I have to admit, I already took it off my list, too, because I wasn't enjoying the first few issues. I have another issue or two in my stack that I need to read from the last month, but I went ahead and submitted a new list today and excluded Justice League, as well as a couple of very difficult decisions I had to make. So,
Such as?
I would rather get to them after we get through our reading section.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
Because it's very controversial, and I'll get to it from there. And it was just because it was very difficult. But anyway, on to my number three book of the week, or book of the period, I should say. I will go with Titans number two. This is a book by Dan Abnett and Brett Booth. And I know it's been out for a while, but again, it's new to me.
It hasn't been out that long, I don't think.
Yeah, it's been out for a couple weeks, I think.
Yeah.
It was good. Another good issue in this series. This continues to be a good reminder of what a Titans series can and should be. A good team dynamic where you're given a reason to care about these characters. But in particular, Wally West is the star of the book. It's a Wally story right now. This story arc is about Wally and Linda Park, the love of his life. And this also included some unraveling of some of the mysteries behind DC Rebirth. So I really like how they're tying in the connection between Wally and Linda. I loved how they used the Flash villain Abracadabra here as somebody who clearly knows the previous time, or knows the destiny of Wally West. He knows that Wally and Linda got married, probably had kids, all this other stuff, but he knows it's not supposed to happen yet because of Wally's age. So it confused me a little bit because of that, because I was like, well, I thought Wally knew about the missing 10 years and all that, but it ties into the greater narrative. It references indirectly Dr. Manhattan, presumably, as somebody who has been influencing history. So really entertaining, good character dynamics. I still don't like Brett Booth's art. It just doesn't work for me. It's better than it has been in the past at times. Although I recently discovered that he drew the Larfleeze Christmas special that is so near and dear to so many hearts.
And by so many, you mean about six.
Right, one of which is mine. Yes. And yours.
Yes.
So Titans number two, very good book. Number three on my list out of four. Go ahead, Nick.
Oh, all right. For my number three, I've got Superman number six. And I know I said last time that I thought Superman number five was putting a bow on the Eradicator story. Turns out I was wrong. We had one more issue of the Eradicator story to get through. Pretty good issue. Had some great moments that I think you will absolutely love. Just expert writing of the Lois, Clark, John family dynamic from Peter Tomasi. Pat Gleason continues to draw young, exuberant faces for children better than just about anybody I know. And just a great book that ends up with Superman introducing himself to the world and then introducing John as Superboy to the Justice League. So some pretty cool moments you'll get to see in this one whenever you finally get around to it. So I got Superman number six as my number three.
Superman number six as your number three. All right. And at my and I'm really looking forward to catching up on that, by the way. You know how much I've loved both the Superman titles in the Rebirth Initiative.
Yes.
I'm on to my number two, which is Detective Comics 939.
I believe that's the most recent issue.
The most recent issue, you are correct. And this is the one in which it ends with Tim Drake staring down again, I'm not spoiling anything in the comic, but it ends with him staring down a potential dangerous fate. A bunch of robots with guns and whatnot, and it's him alone against all these robots. So, or drones, I should say. Vanguard Ones, you might say. This book continues to just really blow me away. I'm so impressed with Detective Comics. I never thought that I would see a Batman title that would be one of the best, if not the best, team book on the stands. And teen book on the stands. Because the characters in this book are young, for the most part.
Right.
But James Tynion IV continues to do a remarkable job writing this, but I want to especially give some love to the artists. both Eddie Barrows, but especially Alvaro Martinez, who I'll get to in a little bit. But Eddie Barrows on this issue killed it, delivering, to me, much better art than he was doing on Nightwing several years ago, more consistent art. And the character moments really shine here. Bruce, Kate, the Batwoman, Cassandra Cain, Stephanie Brown, Tim Drake, Clayface, who continues to almost steal every scene that he's in. Just a great story, a great mystery, a great team dynamic, and a good action book as well. So very, very high on Detective Comics right now. 939 gets my number two.
Absolutely. For my number two, I've got Invincible Iron Man number 13. This is another Civil War II tie-in. And I can tell, and this I've only read, I think this is only the third tie-in issue I've read to Civil War II, but I already feel like this is going to be much like Civil War I in that the tie-ins, essentially, are doing a better job of telling the main story than the main title is. This really gets into Tony's headspace and, like, what his, you know, what he's dealing with in the wake of Rhodey's death. And it does something that hasn't really been done in the main title. It actually shows him mourning the loss of his friend, which is something that was, you know, pretty much unforgivably glossed over in the main series. And this entire book, essentially, is about him, you know, dwelling on what to do now that Rhodey is gone and trying to figure out how to fill that void in his life. So this is an outstanding, outstanding issue of Iron Man comics, and it has me really, really intrigued to see how they wrap this series up and what Tony's status quo is going to be at the end of Civil War II. So Invincible Iron Man number 13 takes the number two spot on my list.
Have they given any indication as to whether the two sides here, correct, are Tony and Carol, correct?
Yes, Tony, Iron Man and Captain Marvel leading two respective sides.
Have they given any indication as to whether the two of them at any point are going to wrestle for 60 minutes?
I am not sure about that. I do know that they will be wrestling for the World Wrestling Federation Championship. Now, whether that'll be for 60 minutes or not, I can't really say. As we all know, Tony will no longer be Iron Man at a certain point in the near future, and thus he would no longer be able to go 60 minutes, based on my understanding of the science of the Marvel Universe.
Right, right. It would then pass the mantle of 60-minute person onto Ironheart.
Of course. Then again, I think if Gorilla Monsoon makes a ruling to the contrary, we have to go by it, and that's just the way it goes.
Oh man, I'll have a lot to say about President Gorilla Monsoon if we ever do that Comics on Wrestling podcast we've been talking about for 3 years. Anyway, on to my number one comic of the week, and here's a twist. It's also Detective Comics. It's Detective Comics 938 by James Tynion IV and Alvaro Martinez. Now, this was the issue directly preceding 939, obviously, given how math works. I thought this hit all of the emotional beats. This was, from the beginning, that's a flashback to the childhood of Batwoman with her father, Colonel Kane, at the graveside of her mother and her sister. And you really get an idea as to their relationship. This is also the first indication that we've gotten that Colonel Kane does still have humanity in him. He's not just a mustache-twirling villain. He's doing what he thinks is right. He is a father, and he cares about his daughter, but he cares about his country and the world just as much. Or almost as much, I should say, because I still think he cares about her the most, and I think in his mind, everything he's doing is for her sake. This was just excellent from beginning to end. The action was great. The dynamic between Batman and Batwoman and all the ancillary players. Clayface has some great comedic moments, and that's what I wanted to bring up. Clayface is the necessary comedic relief here. He fills the role that Alfred often fills in Batman comics, as kind of throwing in that little levity into an otherwise dark and serious story. I really appreciate the use of Clayface here to do that. They make Tim Drake seem like he's valid and important and a useful member of the superhero community, which oftentimes writers have failed to do in favor of making him more bland. they introduce a new villain who's super annoying that I wanted Tim to beat the crap out of. And in fact, Tim does break his arm at one point. That's the kid, what's his name? Ulysses Adrian Armstrong.
Yeah. Something to that effect. Yes.
And, so really annoying villain, a hateable villain, basically the Miz of this organization, and just a super entertaining book. And I really got to spread some love to Alvaro Martinez, however you pronounce it. He has been, and this is one of the controversies I was making, I think he is, for me, the biggest surprise of Rebirth in terms of art. I love this guy's art. Like, he didn't draw the flashback sequences, but he does all the present day sequences, and his work can stand up with all but the very best of the current superhero artists. I love his figures, the way he draws everyone in proportion to one another, the way he does action scenes where you can tell what's going on and the scenes make sense. Big fan of this guy. The book is just tremendous right now. It's firing on all cylinders, and I can't wait to see where it's all heading. And this is, right now, this is my Batman book of choice.
Yeah, for me as well. And, you know, I talked about this book a couple weeks ago when it came out, but one thing I want to shout out now that you've read the book, the specific flashback scene with Kate and Bruce at Bruce's parents' funeral, so good. So good, man. Loved that scene. Loved everything about it. Really makes you understand that Bruce and Kate, you know, do have some sort of affection for each other, even if it's been, you know, altered by the years and altered by their decades of experience.
And by the way, I think that was in 939, actually, if I'm not mistaken, because they did the flashback also in 939.
Ah, okay. Well,
so I think that was, but yeah, point stands. Yeah, absolutely amazing. I have never read a comic that showed me them having any kind of real relationship with one another.
Right.
And so I thought that did more to personify for me why she is Batwoman as opposed to just being some other character with a different name. Because it ties them together thematically and intrinsically beyond just their families knew each other. Really good. Really good.
For my number one book of the week, and this is, you know, this countdown of mine has been full of shocking surprises thus far. So here's another shocker. Aquaman number 6 takes home my number one spot. I am going to wait to say this issue essentially features a showdown between Superman and Aquaman, and Superman is seeking to take Aquaman back into custody after the government calls him in. And I don't want to get too much into detail and into how that goes or whatever, but I will say this. As someone who is, you know, in the past harbored something of a grudge against old Supes, I have always said there's nothing that gives me more perverse pleasure than watching Batman just step up and clock him right across the jaw every once in a while. I think I found something that almost approaches that. Because when Mira cold cocks Superman, it was a stand up and applaud moment for me. Loved it. Absolutely
the Citizen Kane applause moment.
The applause moment. And you see Superman go flying and Mira just kind of smirk. It was brilliant. But I'll withhold from saying a whole lot. I really want you to catch up on Aquaman so we can have some more in-depth discussion about it.
Well, I'll do that. But before I can catch up on Aquaman, I have to catch up on Aquaman!
Indeed.
Riding his noble seahorse. Well, that brings us to the end of this.
No, wait a minute. First of all, I got a few quick hits, and second of all, you were going to tell us about some eliminations you made from your pull list.
That's correct. Yes. So you go first with your quick hits.
Cyborg Rebirth. Almost was my bottom book of the week. Really didn't enjoy this one. Thought the art was weird, and the dialogue was overly expository and on the nose. Just not very interesting, to be honest.
What book was that again?
Cyborg Rebirth.
Ah, yes.
So won't be following that one going forward. Batman number 6. Something of a prologue to the Gotham and Gotham Girl story that also kind of teases the next thing coming up for...
Epilogue, I believe you mean.
Yeah, epilogue. Excuse me. Sorry about that. Kind of gives you an idea of the mental state of Gotham Girl. Really interesting, I thought, and well done. Showing you a more compassionate, heroic side of Batman than we are accustomed to, rather than the gruff and grim exterior that he has always used to deal with those close to him. He really, shows his softer side towards Gotham Girl and helps her through a difficult time of this issue. So.
Which has been a nice addition, I think, of the Rebirth Batman. I think they've done a good job of kind of highlighting that Bruce does have that side to him that sometimes right. It's easy to forget about. So,
and then finally, my last quick hit, Green Arrow number 6. I believe this is the first issue of this series that hasn't made my top 3 since Rebirth started. It was a good book. I just, I'm waiting to see how this little mini story arc wraps up. It seems like they're doing a little 2 or 3 issue story that kind of is attempting to explain what exactly the Amico's deal has been and why she was, had seemingly turned on Oliver for a little bit and how she was playing both sides and all that. And I thought, personally, the motivation didn't quite make enough sense to me, but I'm going to wait and see how the story wraps up before I judge it too harshly. So Green Arrow number 6 just missed my top 3, but got some questions I'd like answered on this one.
Yeah, I can understand that. We'll see when I get to it. I'm looking forward to catching up on Green Arrow. I'm several issues behind. But so I've come to the conclusion after dropping 80-some-odd dollars on my last stack of comics and realizing that that number was only going to increase as the months go on with one-shots and annuals and, additional books such as Super Sons that haven't come out yet that I might want to add.
Justice League of America, Justice League versus Suicide Squad.
So I had to make some changes to my pull list. Some easy, some very, very difficult. The first thing I did immediately, without thinking about it, was to cut Justice League from my pull list. I had no problems doing that. I didn't like either the Rebirth or the first issue, and I don't think I've read any more since then. If I have, I didn't like it. And I just wasn't digging it, wasn't feeling it, didn't seem like an important story, didn't seem like anything that was... I was getting better team action in other books, in other words, so... That was an easy cut, but I was still left with difficult decisions. So I said, you know what? I can live without Suicide Squad. Don't really need a Suicide Squad book. I've never read a Suicide Squad book before, really. So I cut Suicide Squad, even with the Jim Lee art, which was my main draw. I was like, you know what? I love Jim Lee, but I'll try it out in trade. Legitimately, I will try it out in trade because it's cheaper that way, and I like reading that way better anyway. So cut Suicide Squad, we'll read it another time. But that still left me with too many, twice a month, $2.99 books. I said immediately all the monthly books are safe. Titans, I believe, is a monthly book. Safe. Blue Beetle, monthly book. Safe. However, I left a lot to cut from, and so I made the decision. I had to look at all these books, and I had to be honest with myself and say, I like all of the books that were left on my pull list, or else they wouldn't still be on it. I enjoyed all of them, and I said to myself, which of these am I least excited about reading? If I had to pick one, and the one that I picked was Batman.
I can somewhat understand that.
So, sadly, I have had to drop a good Batman book from my pull list, and I'll catch up later on trade. So, it's not, it's no knock on the series. It's been good, but we've said before the standards right now are really, really high, and I wasn't seeing anything in this Batman run so far that seemed particularly revelatory compared to, remember, Snyder's first 5 issues just floored me. The first issue of Hush just floored me. But this was good, but it wasn't that. So I was able to cut it, especially since I already had 2 Batman books on my pull list, and to me, Detective has been the better of the two. So that was the deciding factor. I wanted to keep both Green Lantern books. So that was my decision.
All right. Well, with that, all that being said, why don't we transition into the rundown?
Ah, the rundown. Yes, everyone's favorite news rundown weekly column series, not column, because we don't do that anymore, because I received a very angry phone call from Jim Shooter, former Marvel editor-in-chief, same guy that called Kelly, and he called me and informed me that I was fired for not meeting my deadlines. So that happened, and that sucked, but nonetheless, we moved on to podcasting, and that's where we now bring you our rundown, where we talk about the top news and notes items from around the comic book world, or at least what we deem as the top news and notes items. There are plenty of other things going on, but we're going to hit you with just a few right now, and we're going to start it. We're going to start it with an icon, as Shinsuke Nakamura would say, icon of the comic book world. In my opinion, the GOAT. Although Geoff Johns is my favorite writer in comics, to me, the greatest, most innovative writer in comics, the great Alan Moore, the Bizarre Wizard himself, has announced that he is leaving comics. He is retiring from the industry. And this has been a long time coming for anybody that has paid any attention to Alan Moore. He has sort of had an open disdain for much of the industry for a long time in terms of the business of the industry and even the work that was being done by his colleagues, and has kind of faded from the public eye in many ways. Hasn't put out many prominent works in recent years. He's still been working on a variety of books. But he basically says, quote, "I think I've done enough for comics. I've done all that I can. I think if I were to continue to work in comics, inevitably the ideas would suffer. Inevitably you'd start to see me retread old ground. And I think both you and I probably deserve something better than that." So, with all that said, I think it looks like he's working on a few H.P. Lovecraft comics with his longtime collaborator, Kevin O'Neill. They're working on a book called Cinema Purgatorio and a final League of Extraordinary.
Yeah, I was going to say, some more League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, I know.
Yeah, presumably to finish that out. And, you know, at this point, we make fun of Alan Moore a lot for how embittered and
eccentric
and out of touch he often seems. But this was the most measured interview I think I've seen with him in a while. Like, he seemed at peace with his work, at peace with what he was doing. And that's all you can ask. I mean, the guy at this point, like I've said many times in the past, while I've criticized him, same thing I do with Frank Miller. No matter how crazy they get or crazy they act, it does not diminish from how great their work was.
Absolutely. Now, however, I will caution that, you know, he had said similar things before. He announced a retirement from, quote, mainstream comics back in the mid to early 2000s, I want to say about 2003 or 2004 maybe, and then also he had also said at some point that once he finished his America's Best Comics imprint, the finale to that run, that was going to be his last comics work. And yet he has, you know, come back for the occasional project here and there. I would be surprised if within 2 years he's gone for good. I would say 5 or 6 years from now, I imagine there will be some kind of Alan Moore comic on sale.
Right. And again, this is the guy, for those that don't know, for those that may be new comic book fans, this is the guy that wrote Watchmen, V for Vendetta, From Hell, The Killing Joke, Miracle Man / Marvel Man.
The guy who in seemingly throwaway stories established, like, the building blocks for what Geoff Johns would later come and turn into, like, the greatest Green Lantern run of all time.
Much of the iconography of Geoff Johns' Green Lantern run came from throwaway stories, one-shots written by Alan Moore in the 80s.
Yep.
Just outlandish ideas that were the source.
F-Sharp Bell, yep, for example.
F-Sharp Bell. Who can forget Mogo is an Alan Moore creation.
Yep.
In a throwaway story. Yep. the Call of the Five Inversions, which yep. led to Atrocitus.
Yep.
The introduction of the idea of the doubt in the Green Lantern ring costing Abensur his life because his willpower faded. You know, just incredible stories that were just filled with ideas. He also wrote maybe the greatest Superman story of all time, for the Man Who Has Everything.
Yep.
He also wrote another story considered by some to be the greatest Superman story, Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow. He also wrote the definitive run on Swamp Thing.
I was about to say, specifically, I haven't read a ton of Swamp Thing, but there's a two-part Swamp Thing Batman crossover from that run that is among my favorite things I've ever read. It's really cool. If you've never read it, go and seek it out. The basic premise is Swamp Thing comes to Gotham searching for Abby Arcane because various forces are conspiring to keep them apart, and he encounters pushback from a moral opposition force who claims that their relationship is unnatural, and he winds up holding Gotham hostage as a result, which puts him in conflict with Batman. So it's a really cool story. If you haven't read it, I would highly recommend it.
I put him in such high acclaim because he is the kind of visionary that comics never would have evolved without.
Right.
He provided so many ideas and concepts that inspired those that came after him, that also shaped the very characters he worked on, and also, of course, with V for Vendetta and Watchmen.
Yeah, I was about to say, when we talked about, we had our big Rebirth episode whenever the DC Universe Rebirth special came out, and I think for better or for worse, whether you like the impact it had or you don't like the impact it had, it is undeniable that Watchmen changed the way superhero stories were told for 30 years. I mean, for an entire generation, essentially, that book left a seismic impact, one that cannot be overstated on the industry. So,
yep. And in my opinion, the greatest work in the industry. It's a work that continues to amaze me every time I read it. And, all that being said, I have not had a chance to read a lot of his 90s and 2000s work. I own a lot of it. I just haven't had a chance to get around to reading it yet.
The first volume of League of Extraordinary Gentlemen is the only one I've read, and it's outstanding. I highly recommend it. I have not read the subsequent volumes. But I want to. It's on my lengthy to-read list.
Right. I have the first volume of Promethea and Tom Strong and I think one other of that era. And I have some of his Wildstorm stuff as well, which is crazy. His Wildcats. His first Wildcats arc is insane. If it is the end of the line for him, I agree with you, Nick. I think he'll eventually come back. But if it is the end of the line, hats off to the greatest, man.
Job well done.
Yeah. Yep.
As crazy as he may be and as bitter as he may be at times, it doesn't change what the man accomplished and how significant he has been to the industry. So, big shout out to Alan Moore. Not that he'll want it or need it or ever hear it. So there you go.
Exactly. And from there, we're going to transition off the page.
Oh.
And we're going to go into the And we're going to go into the world of film.
Oh my!
And we're going to start out with some casting news from the DC Extended Cinematic Universe of thing. Questionable quality.
Yes. As you guys will recall, longtime listeners, loyal listeners will recall, I think it was just last week we discussed the tease of Deathstroke in the DCEU, and I mentioned at the time that the hot rumor was that Joe Manganiello of Spider-Man, How I Met Your Mother, Magic Mike, and I believe True Blood fame, I believe he was on True Blood.
Arnold Schwarzenegger film Sabotage.
Absolutely. Was rumored to be playing Deathstroke, and head of DC Films now, Geoff Johns, did come out and confirm that news this past week. So Joe Manganiello is playing Deathstroke in the DC Extended Universe. No word yet on what that will entail, whether that means he will be the main villain in a solo Batman movie, whether that means he will be appearing in Justice League. All that is up in the air at this point. So we just know that Deathstroke is coming, and we know that he's going to be played by Joe Manganiello. So that's pretty much all there is to say on that one. Right, yeah, Greg?
That's all I got to say about that. I don't really have a strong feeling about him one way or the other. I don't know enough about him really as an actor. I haven't seen him enough things. But
yeah, most of my exposure to him is from How I Met Your Mother. So it's I am used to his more comedic side. I do not know how he will be able to portray Slade Wilson, who isn't often comedic.
So, hey, right. And I think that we both are hoping that Slade is the older version of Slade and not the weird new 52 euthanized. That's not the correct terminology.
No, that would imply that he was humanely put down.
Yes. No, the young-ized version of Deathstroke that they used in one of his New 52 arcs.
De-aged.
De-aged, yes. We want the old Death. We want bitter old man Deathstroke.
De-aged and re-eyed, I think, is the
re-eyed,
term.
Re-eyed, yes. And thankfully, that appears to have gone the way of all things. So
thankfully. But yeah, so looking forward to it. Hope he's playing a older, grizzled Deathstroke. And let's keep our fingers crossed for that.
Yep. The next item we got for you is also related to the DCEU in an ancillary kind of way, because Greg Berlanti, who is developing a Booster Gold film for Warner Brothers, has confirmed that it will not be connected to the DC Extended Universe. This is
a weird move. Like, I gotta be honest, I'm not a huge fan of this move.
Really?
No, I'm not.
Tell me why.
The idea is that, you know, you should be able to craft a universe and a form of storytelling that fits, that enables you to tell a variety of different stories. I mean, look at something like the Marvel Cinematic Universe, where you've got the Winter Soldier, which is like a political thriller. You've got, you know, Thor, which is like a fantasy epic. You've got Doctor Strange coming up, which is going to lean really into the mystical and borderline horror aspects of what you can do with an action film. There are so many different colors that Marvel can paint with at this point. You would hope that DC would be able to develop a similar toolbox. And just because, you know, something like Batman v Superman hasn't fit, you know, the tone of what you would think a Booster Gold project would be, that doesn't mean you can't get to a place where Booster Gold has a place in the larger connected DC universe. I just think there's so much potential to tell a variety of stories set in the DC universe that I don't want to see them take the approach of splintering off all their characters into their own standalone worlds, when the one advantage they have over Marvel is they have all their characters. They can do a bigger, better version of a shared universe, and this feels like a step in the wrong direction to me.
Well, before we get too crazy, he did technically say that what Berlanti said was, as of right now, we have no connective tissue to those worlds. It'd be a separate thing. Now, as Newsarama points out, that doesn't mean that it's not in the same cinematic universe necessarily, but rather it's just not going to be as interconnected as we've come to expect with Batman, Superman, and Suicide Squad.
Right.
Which, personally, my first reaction to this news was good, and I hate to say that because I would like to be like you, but quite frankly, I don't want anything like we saw in the theatrical cut of Batman Superman or like we saw in Suicide Squad to bleed through into a Booster Gold movie. I just don't.
No, I agree. I agree with that. I guess I'm looking at it more from the standpoint of, in an ideal world, you don't want to feel like you need to take characters like Booster Gold and characters like Shazam and divorce them from the rest of your universe just because you feel like you have an issue with tone or whatever it may be.
But the beauty of a character like Booster Gold is you can connect him whenever you want to connect him in the future.
That's a good point. That's
because
true.
He's a character that deals in alternate dimensions, who deals in time travels.
Yes.
So you can always connect him later. But I think the idea – right now, like Suicide Squad was built on the idea of what is the reaction to Superman and Batman and the events of that movie. What happens in the fallout of that? You can't go into a Booster Gold movie dealing with those kind of stakes. It just can't. That's
true.
Not the character.
I agree with that. I think my – I guess what I am concerned about is the idea that –
Think of it as like the Marvel Netflix shows and how they are tied into the cinematic universe. Like,
right.
There's almost no reference to it, really.
I agree. But I think my concern is that this could lead to a scenario where certain films are kind of off doing their own thing when really I want, you know, Geoff Johns to be the captain of the ship and to have all the pieces and all the players steering in one direction. And everybody playing a role in getting that universe to where they want to be.
And perhaps a monitor of some kind coming into play at some point in the future.
Or an anti-monitor.
But that's another story for another time. But speaking,
it's a story for many times.
Yes.
Specifically whenever anybody is in the room that we don't want there.
Yes, it's been used to clear many a room in our real life scenarios.
What has cleared more rooms in our lifetime? The anti-monitor or SmackDown versus Raw GM mode?
God, that's a close one. Maybe for sheer numbers, I think the anti-monitor conversation might win out. But for sheer power, the GM mode, I think, would win out. Because like perhaps like more people have been cleared out from a room at one time through GM mode, but the anti-monitor discussion has been used more times to clear a room.
I think you underestimate how many nights we spent playing GM mode for like a solid year.
And then there was a time it backfired on us and Jeremy Reynolds cleared us out of our own room.
He out GM moded us. He pulled out a notebook and started taking notes.
Taking handwritten notes, making an already glacially slow moving process go even slower.
Absolutely. But we digress.
Yes. Let's move on to something more exciting than all that. Let's move on to one of my favorite stories.
One of the more bizarre pieces, like possibly the most bizarre comic book related movie news since the rumor of 60s spy Aunt May being in development.
So, according to The Hollywood Reporter, Fox has acquired the rights to the life story of Stan Lee, with plans to adapt it into an action-adventure movie similar to the movie Kingsman: The Secret Service, which if you haven't seen it, go watch it. It's a great movie. Except in the film, instead of Stan Lee being Stan Lee and, you know, a comic book writer who, you know, says funny lines and has a funny accent, in the movie, he's going to be a hero with an alter ego, much like his own creations. So, and they have likened it to Roger Moore's 007, with Stan Lee as the main character. Now, this is one of the more bizarre stories, but also one of the most awesome stories that I've heard in quite some time.
The only way this could be better, Greg, and I dare not even say it. I dare not even say it because it's going to inflate your hopes. The only way this could be better would be instead of it being just a straight-up Stan Lee movie, it was a Stan Lee and Jim Steranko movie.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. With Jim Steranko playing Jim Steranko.
With the dude whoever runs the fake Steranko Twitter account writing all the dialogue for Jim Steranko.
And all the scenarios that happen.
And all the – basically writing the movie.
I am so excited to see who they cast. Oh, and the movie takes place in the 70s, by the way, which makes it even better. I can't wait to see who they cast as Stan Lee. I will just throw this out there because I think he could do the accent. And after seeing The Nice Guys, I love him in the 70s setting. I'm just throwing Ryan Gosling out there. Just saying.
The gauze for Stan Lee.
The gauze for Stan Lee. With the accent that he did in Nice Guys being in the 70s, I can hear him saying, "Hello there, true believers." And I want to hear him talk about, when I created Spider-Man, I'm assuming that his secret identity will be a comic book writer and that he's actually a super spy.
This movie has to be titled Excelsior, by the way.
Yes, Excelsior, absolutely. And I want to hear him, you know, when he's seducing a lady as you would in a or Bond movie. I want to hear him say, "I'd like you to remove your undergarments."
Is this a Stan Lee movie or a Mort Goldman movie?
Can it be both, Nick? Can't it be both?
I suppose so. I suppose. But no, this sounds insane and amazing.
Remove your trousers like the Incredible Hulk's trousers are removed each time he transforms from Bruce Banner into the Incredible Hulk.
Go ahead and drop your trousers. It's bugger in time. Oh, God.
No, that's good.
This, I can't wait for this. This sounds awesome. I hope it actually happens. It sounds like one of those things that, you know, could possibly get caught up in development hell and never see the light of day, but I really hope that turns out to not be the case for this.
Wait a minute. Oh, hang on. I'm getting a message. I'm currently getting an email message in our secret hard-traveling fanboys dual email account that we keep. Hang on. Let me open it here.
Mm-hmm.
From 1D Meltzer regarding Stan Lee action-adventure biopic. Oh, my God. Nick, Meltzer's given the idea 5 stars.
And actually, that makes a lot of sense because an idea so bizarre could only come from the great nation of Japan.
That's right. This movie is going to be filmed at the Tokyo Dome. All the stars. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that wraps up the first half of our broadcast. When we come back on the other side, we're going to have an in-depth discussion about a book that was brand new to me, and that is Kevin Smith and Joe Quesada's 1998 Daredevil run, the story arc titled Guardian Devil, with inks by Jimmy Palmiotti of Harley Quinn, Jonah Hex, All-Star Western, etc. fame. So stay tuned through the break. We hope you enjoy it. Don't you dare go away.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you're subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Just head to iTunes today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be podcast feed, the PWO PTBN feed, PTBN Pop, and of course the Kevin Kelly Show feed, which includes the full archives of my podcasts. Some really great stuff. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. Thanks for being a fan of professional wrestling. More importantly, thanks for being a fan and supporter of the Place to Be Nation.
Place to Be Nation is JT Rizzero here. In addition to the archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. And we now offer them to you on 2 great feeds. On the Place to Be podcast feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous vintage vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current day wrestling with clotheslines and headlines, main event, Mission Indie Possible, in our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. Relive Wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. All of this in addition to Scott Keith's Podcast of Doom, which includes discussions on questions from listeners as well as current day and old school wrestling. We also have sports covered too with the Sports Lounge, the TJ McClune Show, and NBA Team Podcast. On our brand new PTB Pop podcast feed, we offer great shows such as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both feeds on iTunes and be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows are available on PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to check out on the right-hand side of the site for details on how to support the site when you shop at Amazon and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the pro wrestling only Place to Be Nation podcast network. That's the PWO PTBN podcast network, where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickenspan, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the Reaction Shows with Good Old Will from Texas. We got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Teams Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course, there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network.
Time has arrived. We are broadcasting Raw Live from my ass. Boom, boom. I'd rather watch two old women slap my ass. Woo! That's as tough as a chunk of my ass. Here comes the biggest ass. The big man is back. Jim Ross. 350 pounds. You say hello to my ass. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the greatest spectacle on earth. My ass. 30 men will enter. My ass. You know what I mean. The most important thing to a tag team is my ass.
I totally agree with you, JR.
Here you go, King. Kiss my ass.
I wish you would jump on top of me, JR.
It disgusts me to see my ass.
My daughter's nursery rhymes are more aggressive than this. I can't help but look at the butt, JR.
What?
Welcome back, Place to Be Nation pop listeners. We trust you enjoyed those commercials and Parv's soothing voice, as well as the voices of Kevin Kelly, Justin Rosero, and others. Maybe
is it
others.
Justin Rosero or is it JT Rosero? The world may never know.
I feel like we're breaking the fourth wall, brother.
That's the fourth wall, brother.
That's what you call a clutch reference, Nick. That's good. Well done. All right.
That's when you take your chocolate and you put it on your peanut butter and you put your peanut butter on your chocolate.
Yep. That was expertly done, amigo. Now, back to the business at hand. Let's flash back, ladies and gentlemen, to the year that was 1998. Are you ready? Are you picturing it? Austin is stomping mud holes in people and walking them dry.
The Wolfpack is putting people in a body bag.
Conan is uttering gibberish every Monday night.
Bill Goldberg is spearing the living bejesus out of people.
Bill Clinton is fornicating with secretaries, or talking about having fornicated with secretaries, or not, depending on your definition of what
is.
Saturday Night Live was still good.
The world is preparing for the release of Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace.
The world was also preparing for the release of Starship Troopers.
Austin Powers, the spy who shagged me.
American Beauty.
And various other 1998 film properties.
I believe American Beauty was 99, in fact. But that beside the fact.
And let us not forget, still relevant baseball superstar, Cecil Fielder.
And if we can get him away from the set of Crocodile Dundee 3, Paul Hogan will be here, folks. Right here on the Hard Traveling Fanboys. But we're trying to get you in the mindset that it's 1998. Now, film auteur, writer, director, actor, Kevin Smith.
Not yet podcaster at this point.
Not yet podcaster. Riding a wave of popularity, arguably at the zenith of his popularity, in the wake of the creation of Mallrats and Clerks. What else had he done at that point, Nick?
Chasing Amy, Dogma.
Dogma, which I believe came out the same year, correct? 98?
Fairly sure that's correct. Do not quote me on that one, though.
Interesting.
That may have been 99. At the very least, when the book we're going to talk about comes out, he has either worked on Dogma or he is in the midst of working on Dogma.
Right, and it's very appropriate that he was, because thematically, that film, of all of his films, of all of his works, has the most to do with the book that we're talking about today, which is Guardian Devil. It is a book written by Kevin Smith, his very first foray into superhero comics. And really, legitimately his first foray into comics. He had written some Jay and Silent Bob stuff, some stuff set in his universe that he had created for his films, but he had never really done a work for a major publisher that was an actual honest to God comic book. And in 1998, Marvel, which had seen better days, was struggling to get by.
Yes, they had actually filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy in 1998 and were so desperate for anything that might turn the company around, they actually wound up giving Joe Quesada and a few other creators full control of some of their characters, and that was what created the now iconic Marvel Knights imprint. Characters like, if I remember correctly, the Black Panther,
Punisher.
Daredevil, obviously, Punisher, the Inhumans. And so he was able to, by giving Quesada this level of control, Quesada basically reached out to various talents like Kevin Smith, like guys who are now in the industry pretty hardcore, like Brian Michael Bendis. You know, those kind of guys were brought in to work on mainstream Marvel books after careers of just working in indie comics. So, this was really, looking back on it, it was incredibly risky at the time, but it wound up being one of the most significant things Marvel has ever done for its long-term, survival, honestly. Marvel Knights, while it wasn't a sales juggernaut, because nothing was a sales juggernaut in 1998... turned around the reputation of the company, I would say.
It did. And for that time, it was for what was going on, it was the sales buoy that they needed to sustain themselves and put their heads above water, because the industry was collapsing in and of itself. Marvel in particular was collapsing into itself. DC, at least at that time, did have Grant Morrison's JLA that was doing really good numbers.
Right.
Mark Waid's Flash was doing good numbers. But Marvel was collapsing at this point in the weight of onslaught, in the wake of the Clone Saga, in the wake of bad financial decisions that were made in the company, and pissing off creators along the way.
Right. And this wound up being so wildly popular that it set the stage for Joe Quesada to be named editor-in-chief of Marvel. I mean, this was almost like a test run for that gig, if you look at it, with hindsight now. And it wound up, leading to a very lengthy run for him on top of the company that, you can, debate creatively whether or not you agreed with a lot of his moratoriums and decisions. But I think there's no question that financially he turned the company around.
Absolutely. And for a little background on Joey Q, as we sometimes lovingly, sometimes not refer to him, my first exposure to Joe Quesada was actually through Batman.
Right.
When he did the miniseries Batman Sword of Azrael that introduced the character
with
of Azrael.
Neal.
Yes, it introduced the character of Azrael, obviously. Jean-Paul Valley, it was part of two miniseries that kind of led into Nightfall. Sword of Azrael and Vengeance of Bane. He illustrated that. I believe he had also worked on X-Factor. I think he had worked on a few other books here and there. And he was known for his kind of bombastic 90s action style. You know, if you've ever read Sword of Azrael, it's giant guns and giant swords and flames everywhere. By the way, he also worked on The Ray when it got relaunched at DC, which I recently read for the first time, the miniseries that relaunched The Ray for DC. He did the art for that and had a very distinct artistic style, but yet you can tell that it's influenced by the Image guys.
Very much so, yes.
The Jim Lees, the Rob Liefelds, people like that.
But that was the style of the time.
Yes, exactly. And there's nothing wrong with that. So, but he was very good at what he did, and he got a reputation for that, and that's why Marvel gave him the keys to this kingdom. Now, I'm going to turn it over to you, Nick, to give us a little bit – we've kind of already talked about it, but where was Kevin Smith at this point in his career?
So my understanding of it is that Kevin Smith, had kind of done had done some things. Obviously, he had hit it big with Clerks and kind of burst onto the scene – And throughout Clerks, you know, there are references to various science fiction and pop culture properties, comic books a little bit. And then when he made Mallrats, obviously he turned up the comic book references to the nth degree. And it was during the making of Mallrats that he met various people, you know, in the comics industry, and kind of, you know, met various people at DC Comics. He wound up working on a Superman script that we'll eventually at some point discuss more in detail on this podcast. You know, he had started to get, you know, acquainted with various figures in the comics universe. And he had, like you said, experimented with doing some of his own characters in comic form. But also, you know, he at some point, I'm kind of fuzzy on the details, but established a fairly close friendship with Joe Quesada. And so when Quesada was able to gain control of these characters, one of Quesada's first phone calls was to Kevin Smith, because he realized that, you know, with the company in the shape it was, you needed any kind of mainstream buzz you could attract. And with Dogma getting ready to come out, with Chasing Amy being kind of restoring Smith's reputation as a critical darling at that time, a reputation which he has since squandered in wonderful fashion, Quesada smartly thought it would be a wise move to bring him on. And he also knew that Kevin was a lifelong Daredevil fan. And that kind of led to the creation of this, Guardian Devil. Which we should talk about a little bit. So I read it probably about 6 months or a year ago. I can't really remember for the first time, and then reread it for this podcast. This was your first exposure to it, Greg. And to start with, I guess, I mean, what were your thoughts, you know, going into it?
Obviously, I knew the reputation because to give a little backstory of my own, when I first got into the online comic book community was probably around the time I first got to college, which was 2002, around that same time that I picked up Hush for the first time, as I've told that story many times. So I was familiar. I would read different comic book websites, including a Place to Be Nation family member, Ben Morse, who was writing for some of the websites or for one of the websites I was reading back then. And I would read, you know, forum postings by people that would reference Kevin Smith's Daredevil as this, you know, pretty esteemed book in the field, particularly in the mid-2000s. Like, that was one of the classic works that was held up. It's like, oh, that's good, but is it as good as Miller's Daredevil or Smith's Daredevil? Or is it as good as, you know, just the classic runs that you think of, you know, the Denny O'Neil Batman or whatever. And the so I knew the reputation of this book. I didn't really know what it was about. I knew that – well, before I get into any of this, how far into spoilers do you want to get with this? Do we want to keep it spoiler-free as we typically do, or what is – what? Because there's a – I'll put it this way.
I think there are things in this book that we – like, you can't really have a full discussion of this book without discussing some spoilers, because unlike many, many titles, there are things that happen in this book that have long-lasting impacts on the Matt Murdock character. So
yeah.
I think we're going to have to be a little bit more liberal with our spoiler stance, and I'd say let's have a spoiler-inclusive discussion today.
Yeah, and so right now I'm going to warn everyone that's listening right now, if you don't want spoilers, tune out and go check out this book through Amazon, through your local comic shop.
Or through the exquisite Marvel Unlimited
app. I recommend it. Check it out. So read it for yourself. But this is the story that has one of the defining moments in Matt Murdock's life, of which there are several. But this story has the death of Karen Page. And I knew that going in because I remember – the only thing that I remember people talking about in reference to this run was Kevin Smith's Daredevil run where they killed off Karen Page and how that would shape Matt Murdock's life in the decades going – forward. So I knew that's all I knew about the story, though. I didn't even know that Quesada had drawn it until I started reading it. So that's kind of how I approached it, expecting something really good and groundbreaking and expecting to see a prominent character death. But I didn't know what else to expect going in. And also, I guess because I am familiar with Kevin Smith's Green Arrow, I was expecting more of a humorous book than I got.
Yes, that's one thing I would say the first time I read it as well, is the humor from his Green Arrow and some of his other comics work was not... I mean, this book had funny moments, don't get me wrong. He still writes quippy, sarcastic dialogue very well, but it is a much more straightforward comic story than I would say his Green Arrow is.
Yeah, there were no laugh-out-loud moments for me. There were a couple chuckles here and there, but it's not like Green Arrow where it was like constant laughs throughout the book because right. of the scenarios and the writing. And it's, I guess that's appropriate for the character because right. Daredevil is a character that is not, unlike Oliver Queen, is not steeped in the absurd.
Particularly, it's probably appropriate for this era of Daredevil because I'm fuzzy on the details because I'm far from a Daredevil expert, but as is revealed in the opening pages of the book, Matt Murdock is still reeling from Karen Page walking out of his life roughly 6 months earlier.
Right, and as backup to that, I will say that I had read a Kevin Smith Daredevil story before this, but let me tell you what issue it was. Daredevil number 0, which was a Wizard magazine exclusive that was later released online by Marvel Comics. I read it about 5 years ago because somebody posted it on a website. Might have been Marvel that posted it on their website. I can't remember, but I read it. It was the web version of Daredevil number 0 that featured and it was not much to it, honestly, as I recall. It was just Daredevil. Or maybe it was the Daredevil 1/2, I can't remember, but it was Daredevil swinging through the city and reminiscing about his relationship with Karen Page, and I think it ends where he shows up and finds the letter that you see in Daredevil number 1.
Right.
So, yeah, it picks up there, and yeah, it's a story that's steeped in Daredevil's history, steeped in Daredevil's relationship with Karen Page, his past relationships, and all the stories presumably in the 90s that had been leading into this one that both you and I, Nick, didn't really have any knowledge of.
Right. There are references made to the Kingpin attempting to drive him crazy and the Kingpin knowing everything about his life and some dealings with Typhoid Mary that I was vaguely familiar with but, you know, certainly hadn't read those stories.
Sure. I know the events, particularly some of the imagery they used in flashback sequences. A lot of it was Frank Miller's run that right. was heavily influential on Kevin Smith. But there were other, like, more recent things like, you know, Karen Page as a porn star and stuff like that. That played a heavy factor in this story that were things that I had no other than hearing about them online or whatever. I had never really read them or never really understood the details behind them.
Yeah, Karen had gone through quite a tough time with a drug addiction and, like you said, an adult film career. So they had kind of really put her through the ringer. And my understanding is that she and Matt were finally back together after she was able to get her life together after a long period of suffering. And so this was kind of the first real bump in the road after their, reunion, so to speak.
And pretty much as soon as they're back together, Karen decides she's going to leave to go find herself. And so that's where Big Kev kicks us off in this story. Karen has left Matt, and it's just the latest in a long line of horrible events to happen to Matt in his life that leave him emotionally distraught. Particularly his encounters with women have always ended in pain and heartbreak for him. So he's already in a fragile emotional state when the story starts. And then he comes across this baby that's left in his possession. And there is without spoiling too much of the story, because I really don't want to ruin the whole story for everyone, there is a villain who is manipulating Matt's life in an attempt to break him, in an attempt to emotionally and spiritually in particular break him by using his own faith against him.
Right.
Because Matt Murdock, for those that don't know, there was a red Daredevil or watched it, is a devout Catholic. Well, I say devout, but he's kind of a lapsed Catholic. But he grew up a Catholic and...
A conflicted Catholic would be the best way I could put it.
Right. And his faith is a part of who he is. And right. It, both positively and negatively, has affected him throughout his life.
It is something he both finds strength in, but is also continuously... conflicted by and continuously
right.
finds almost as another set of rules and another set of limitations that he has.
Right. And so he is doubting himself, doubting his faith when the story kicks off. And this villain uses that to attack Matt on a level that I have not read enough Daredevil to say this definitively, but it feels like the Daredevil stories that I have read or that I've seen adapted on the screen have tended to go after Matt physically or to go after those who Matt cares about. I had not really encountered anyone going after his faith like that.
Seeking to cause such a severe mental break with, you know, a large part of who he is, you know.
Yes, and it's important to note that this story revolves around a baby who Matt is told is either the Antichrist or the Savior come to life.
And that sounds weird because I think most people, when you think of Daredevil, you're thinking of very street level stories, and so the premise of that probably sounds like, wow, that's kind of a big topic for Daredevil. It kind of feels a little bit too supernatural. A little bit too out there for your typical Daredevil story, but of course, you know, not all is as it seems.
And yeah, I was about to say that, Nate, because it really threw me off, especially in the early chapters of this, the first two or three issues. It really threw me off because I was like, man, I'm not really reading Daredevil to see wizards and demons and crap, and you know, like that's not really what I go to it for. And I was just like, you know, this is a little on the ham-handed side, because I didn't see the deception. I knew something was up, but I didn't know until it became more clear as the story progressed, and by the end, it all makes sense. It's a decompressed story for sure, but it decompressed and compressed, I would say, in one, but it pulls the wool over the reader's eyes as much as it does Matt's eyes, which is to its credit.
And really, I thought it did a great job, especially as we said, there's a mysterious villain kind of, you know, manipulating these events. And honestly, I didn't put it together until Matt put it together. Like, it was not one of those situations where, you know, the reader is ahead of the character. It came as a genuine surprise to me when it finally happened.
Yeah, me too. It's one of those shocks that really got me. Just like you know, the twists and turns in Hush, or the twists and turns in Long Halloween. When you read these great mystery stories, this was a really good twist. This was a really good mystery because it kept me guessing until the end. I made guesses throughout. My initial guess, once everything was underway, was the Rose, the little known villain who I believe is Wilson Fisk's brother. Is that correct? I think so.
I'm not positive.
He's like a villainous character who I thought, you know, was involved here somehow, because it would make some level of sense. But no. But the way that Smith and Quesada unravel this mystery and they keep the villain shrouded in shadow ends up being very satisfying and also very angering when you think about his reasoning for why he does what he does to Matt, because his reasoning is very weak. You know, as far as like why his reason, he doesn't have a just reason for going after Matt. It's just, you know, so it's a very well-crafted mystery.
Right.
Story.
I think what you're saying is that the motivation that was given to him by Smith and Quesada was weak. I think you're saying
that character's
reasoning is so petty and so
right,
like small, that it winds up coming off as like a truly detestable series of actions by him, because he has no real personal reason to come after Matt Murdock. For all intents and purposes, he did it to garner attention and nothing else.
Yep.
Which is, like, you know, the biggest supervillain act one can pull off, I suppose.
Yes, I would agree. It was the story takes you on a journey that truly has escalating action as it goes along, and it escalates and it escalates and it escalates, and the stakes, because as the supernatural stakes lower, the personal stakes grow as the story goes on.
Right.
And it turns into something that is really impactful and certainly impacted me in some of the later issues in particular.
Right. Just great. I mean, Kevin Smith does emotional, or at this time in his life, did emotional dialogue really well. I mean, I'm thinking of, you know, scenes like the big breakup scene in Chasing Amy. I'm thinking of various bits of Dogma where he really went for the emotional heartstrings and pulled it off. And there are numerous instances of this in this book. I thought, personally, my favorite bits of dialogue in the book almost always came whenever Matt Murdock was having a conversation with the Black Widow.
I
thought those exchanges were written so well, and he had such a crystal clear, interpretation of who, not only who those characters were, but what their dynamic was with one another. It was relatable. You got it. And it felt natural whenever those characters were having a conversation. I loved every time they were on panel together, every time. And then also, you know, this is some mild spoiler territory here. They eventually introduce Matt's mother as a character, and every time that she and Matt had a scene together,
yeah,
I was like, man, this is just really powerful. And then of course, at a certain point, they bring Karen Page back into the story, and every time she and Matt have a conversation, it's just he seemed to have a handle on Matt's supporting cast in a way that I don't think a lot of writers have ever had. Even though, like I said earlier, I've never read a bad Daredevil story. I haven't read many, but I will say that I don't think anybody has ever handled Matt's world around him, that I've read anyway, quite as well as Kevin Smith did. I thought, and that goes to show you just like how much love he had for these characters and what a deep understanding he had of how all these characters relate to Matt Murdock. I thought that was among the best aspects of the book, was the supporting cast.
Absolutely. You mentioned in particular his relationship with his mother in the book. And one of the most effective issues to me, and an issue that really, really struck a chord with me, and a scene that really struck a chord with me, was when he is having a shouting match. Well, not a shouting match. He's shouting at his mother, who abandoned him when he was young, about, you know, she's a nun, and he's shouting at her about God, about his lack of faith, and she responds to his anger by telling him a story like he was a child. And then Kevin Smith, the art from Quesada is excellent and just moving, but what gets it is the way that Smith writes the story and the way that he writes the inner monologue of Matt Murdock, because the culmination of that scene when Matt explains that she's telling him a story, and then he says, and suddenly I'm a kid again. And it's like, it was so impactful, because it works on so many levels, because this is the woman who abandoned him when he was a kid and never got a chance to read him a story. And so on one level, he's a kid being told a story, and on another level, he's a kid seeing his faith again for the first time.
Natasha brings up in the book, this is the woman who, you know, basically set the stage for all of Matt's unhealthy relationships with women for the rest of his life. Like,
yep.
It all can be traced back to this, you know, the absence of this relationship with his mother.
Yep. Just the anger from Matt. And this is truly where Kevin Smith shines as a writer in general. Is he is at his best when he is writing relationships between people.
Right.
He's at his worst when he's trying to do anything else. But when he's just writing relationships between people, he is so good, or at least he was at that time, so good at it. And the fact that this is the same guy who got popular, I mean, let's face it, by writing dick jokes and things like that in his movies, but he can still draw genuine emotion out of you when you least expect it. That's just that's a rare skill. A rare skill to have, and he at that time was on fire. And I think that if you read this and you watch Dogma, I'd suspect
that this comes. Yeah. You know, I feel like both of these come from the same place in him, wherever that is, and that conflict. Dogma is a more comedic look at it, and this is his more straightforward, serious take on the issues he was having within himself at this time.
Yep, it's very much an inner conflict, and I will be the first to say I don't think comic books hardly ever handle religion well. I've never thought they have, particularly superhero comics. I think that the pendulum swings one way or the other, and particularly in the modern era, a lot of comic creators tend to be atheists, so comics tend to come off in some cases as anti-religion when they tackle religious issues, which is fine. But for me, I prefer something that toes the line a little bit more. And that is what I think that's why I think Kevin Smith's religious writing always appealed to me, because he's not heavy-handed about how he approaches it. You know, he doesn't tell you, okay, Matt, you know, Matt's beliefs are real or what you should believe. He doesn't tell you that Matt's beliefs are stupid and anyone who believes them are stupid. He just lays it out there, and he lays out the conflict that people feel. And you identify with, or for a lot of us, I identify with it when I read it. And the ending in particular was uplifting and just inspirational, and it was done in the least heavy-handed way possible, because it was Matt Murdock finding his own personal truth. And Kevin Smith's ability to write that at that time is why I think at that time, in my opinion anyway, he was at the height of his powers, because Dogma, as you know, Nick, is my favorite Kevin Smith movie. And always has been. And I think it's because those themes that he approached, I think he did it in a way that people are either afraid or unable to do when they try to broach the same topic.
I agree. I mean, there's a lot of stuff here. I feel like just, you know, really quickly, let's give a brief breakdown of the plot. You know, Greg mentioned this child that has been left in Daredevil's care, and Murdock has been told that the child could potentially be the Messiah or the Devil, or excuse me, the Antichrist. And so, over the course of the story, Matt encounters these various groups who are both claiming to want possession of the child. And all, you know, while this is going on, you've got the backdrop of Matt struggling with depression over Karen Page leaving him, and you've also got Foggy being caught up in this strange affair that is so out of character for Foggy, where Foggy at this point was in a long-term relationship, but he gets caught up in this like affair with a divorcee that winds up with her body being found and Foggy being arrested for murder. And so you kind of have, you know, Matt's closest friend, you know, being arrested. You have Matt wanting to defend Foggy, and that causing issues for him at the law firm he was working at the time, for Foggy's mother, actually. And so you have Matt's professional life falling apart. You have Matt's personal life in shambles, as Greg mentioned. You have Matt's struggle with his faith at possibly an all-time low. And throughout the course of the story, you also have his interactions with the Black Widow, where you see that Matt's actions are driving even possibly his most loyal supporter within the superhero community away. And so it's like piece by piece, you can see all the things that make Matt Murdock who he is falling apart around him. And it's like he is powerless to stop any of it for the majority of the story. And the mystery of the book, as Greg said, is really who is pulling this these strings, and more importantly, why are they pulling these strings? But what it does in such expert fashion is it weaves classic Daredevil characters into the plot. The Kingpin is only in one scene in this book, in a flashback scene, but it's a hell of an effective Kingpin scene, I thought.
Yeah.
And then the usage of Bullseye when it comes time for Bullseye to make his entry into the story, I thought that was an excellent usage of Bullseye as well.
Oh, totally. Especially if you know the relationship between Bullseye and Daredevil over the years, and what Bullseye had already taken from Daredevil in the past.
Right.
So that was great. You see the interweaving of all these things, and it allows Kevin Smith to play with all of these other members of the Marvel Universe. Doctor Strange pops up in a prominent cameo. It probably the turning point issue, I would say, of when things start to reveal themselves and everything starts to unravel, and you and Matt start to realize exactly what is going on and what's causing all this, right, as the Nature Boy might say. And so you see him pop up. You see, obviously, the Black Widow pops up. And in the best cameo, in my opinion, you see Spider-Man pop up.
Yeah, I want to get to that at a certain point. So
we'll hold off on that. Yeah. But no, it allows that. Interestingly, though, there were some aspects we mentioned earlier, the continuity of this, which is taking place in 1998. And some of the things that are referenced include Ben Reilly's tenure as Spider-Man, right, some other things that are brought up, but some things that I was not aware of. For instance, I didn't know that Foggy's mom was a character.
Yes.
I didn't know that she was a partner.
I didn't either until
Matt
this.
Foggy. I didn't know that she was apparently a cold-hearted, venomous woman.
Apparently, my understanding of it, based on the ending of this book, is that at some point, the Kingpin destroyed Nelson and Murdoch, and they did not have the ability to rebuild their own firm, and Foggy was forced to turn to his mother, who he didn't really have a relationship with, for assistance, and that is why they were working for Foggy's mother at that point. And I could be wrong on that, but that is my understanding of the situation.
The other thing that I didn't know is that Foggy is in a committed relationship with Liz Osborne, who is Harry Osborne's wife. Now, this might actually put things into context for you, Nick, that they went after the villain behind this goes after Foggy through this divorcee because perhaps that's Foggy's quote unquote type, because Liz Osborne was a grieving widow.
Good point.
After the death of Harry, who is dead at this point, as he still should be in the comics. That's another story for another time. And she and Foggy fell for each other and are in a relationship at this point, which I didn't know. I never knew that Foggy Nelson was in a relationship with Liz Osborne.
I thought the Osborne name was strange the first time I read it. I never knew that was Harry Osborne's widow. So,
yep,
there you go.
So, very interesting time capsule there. But you know what's remarkable about this story is it does not feel dated.
It really doesn't. No, and that's, you know, Kevin Smith has a tendency to rely on pop culture so heavily, and this really is a story that doesn't do that. He doesn't fall on that crutch, and thus it doesn't feel as dated as some of his other works tend to feel.
Right.
And really
I also thought, again, talking about the writing, I've often made the argument to you, Nick, that I enjoy Kevin Smith the most in general when he is restricted in some way, when he has an editor, and in particular his Green Arrow run. I really love the movie Jersey Girl that a lot of people aren't as high on, but I think that because he's restrained here in terms of he's not able to necessarily use the language that he would use in most of his movies, he's not using the some of the go-to jokes and stuff.
Right.
I think that it forces him to use his more creative side.
And you can kind
really
of see him refine his comics writing technique as the series goes along. Because
agreed,
one of the things you and I discussed offline, the first issue and into the second issue, when you read it, you're like, my God, I must have just read a double-sized issue because of how long it takes you. And you look back on it and you go, no, that's the standard, you know, 25-page comic or whatever it is. And you go back and you look, and it's because he has packed every panel with either interior monologue or word balloons or – I mean, there are more words in that first issue than possibly any comic I've read outside of the Grant Morrison, like, prose issue of Batman, you know? Like, it is loaded with dialogue and writing. And as the series goes along, you see Kevin Smith, like, almost learn how to be a more visual comics writer. How to restrain himself and know when was enough and when was too much and when he could turn on that, you know, intense level of dialogue that he loves to write.
I felt bad for Joe Quesada in the first few issues because I read that first issue. I told you, Nick, like when I first started, I read it was 8 issues long. I was like, it won't be too bad because I remember, you know, when I read Civil War on Unlimited, it flew by. But I did the panel by panel viewing because I was reading it on my iPhone. And doing issue number one of Smith's Daredevil on the iPhone, panel by panel, I thought it was a 48-page comic. I got done with it, and I said, Jesus, God almighty, that was long. And I looked at it, and it said, page 22 of 22. And I said, are you freaking kidding me? You know, it's just jam-packed with, like – I know that, like, Chris Claremont, people say sometimes he would have a tendency to overload the dialogue on pages. This is like that on crack. So, but as the series progresses, and I think that's why I enjoyed the story more as it went along, because in those early issues, it didn't feel like Kevin was writing a comic. It felt like he was writing
a script.
A script, yep. Yeah. And as it goes along, he starts to trust Joe Quesada more as the visual storyteller. And the whole story starts to flow better. Like the last 3 issues that I read flowed so much better than the first 5. And you're right. It's watching somebody learn the craft as they go. And I truly, truly, and this is no knock on his movie work. I truly wish he had worked more in comics than he did when he was still in his creative peak. When he was, you know, he does Daredevil and then maybe a couple years later he does Green Arrow, and then he goes away for a while.
Yep.
I wish that he had done regular comics work for a while because he was getting pretty damn good.
He was getting great. I mean, at that point, he had given us an all-time Daredevil run and an all-time Green Arrow run. So, I mean, he was getting damn good. One of the things we've already referenced, Greg, is the death of Karen Page. This is something we both knew about, I think, coming into the story, but I just want to say that the sign of a great scene and an overly effective emotional scene is when you know it's coming and it's still an emotional gut punch when it happens. The way they draw Matt Murdock in that moment is heartbreaking when that scene
comes. Quesada and Palmiotti knocked that scene out of the park. One of the better illustrated death scenes in comics.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then, you know, the issue immediately following the death deals mostly with Matt's final confrontation with this villain who has caused everything that Greg and I don't really want to spoil. But what I love about this book, about the storyline, is most modern day comics, for sure, the trade collection or the story would end on that death scene. And that would be the final scene for one hell of a cliffhanger. Not only does the story not end there, it doesn't even end after Matt has had his final confrontation with the villain. The story ends with Matt having to, like, deal with his emotions of what has happened to him. Deal with the fallout of the events of this story. And I thought that last issue, issue number 8, was the best of the entire run. And it was because, like we've said before, it was Kevin Smith at his best. It was Kevin Smith writing just gut-punching emotional dialogue. Those scenes of Matt reminiscing on his times with Karen in his apartment were amazing, dude.
Oh, Lord, yeah. The second-to-last issue, I think it was the one right after Karen died.
Oh, where he's in his apartment. Oh, my God, yes.
And he's got the Lethal Weapon moment. the Riggs and Lethal Weapon moment where he's got the gun and he's got it up to his head. That is as good a scene of grief as I've seen in a comic.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, I can't say the best, but it's as good as any that I've
seen. It might be the best, and let me tell you why. So many times in superhero comics, when a death happens, it almost gets glossed over temporarily so that they can wrap up the central conflict of whatever story has caused that death. But here, they smartly pause for several pages to show you the emotional anguish of Matt Murdock before he attempts to confront this villain that has caused all this. They show you him having an emotional breakdown over what has happened to him. They show you just how much this hurts him. And that scene like that you're referencing, yeah, it's heartbreaking, man, because you see him just kind of lose it at one point and just start breaking everything in his apartment because he doesn't know how to handle what has happened to him.
Yeah, and if I'm not mistaken, and some of the more proficient Daredevil experts out there may be able to correct me on this, but I believe it was also playing off of a Frank Miller issue where Daredevil had a gun in his hand and had it up to his head and was considering pulling the trigger and maybe even played Russian roulette at one point. And it's a great issue that Miller did back in the 80s, I believe. And another layer of Kevin Smith's references to this tragic history that Matt's had. I mean, Daredevil is probably the most tortured character in superhero comics, in my opinion, I would say.
He'd have to be up there, yeah, for sure.
It's can't think of anybody that really has gone through more, and just an outstanding scene. And that last issue, I haven't read a ton of Daredevil, and I think that there, as far as a complete story arc goes, I think that I prefer some of the Brubaker Daredevils that I've read. But as far as a single issue goes, that last issue is the best Daredevil issue I've ever read.
It was amazing, man. It basically, the entire issue is like Matt at Karen's funeral, and there are moments like Matt attempting to give a eulogy, and in like the most uncommon, because you're so used in comic books to seeing that you know, very eloquent and loquacious eulogy delivered at a funeral, and there, they underplay it so well when Matt literally can't find the words and can't find the power to speak, and he just like apologizes to Karen and walks away. Like it's so powerful. And then let's talk about that scene you referenced earlier. I think, for my money, the best scene outside of perhaps the Karen Page death, but the best scene in this entire run was Spider-Man attempting to console Daredevil on top of the bridge in New York that Matt is unaware of, but it's the same bridge that the Green Goblin threw Gwen Stacy from, leading to her death. And so you see in one of the best panels of this book, you see Spider-Man is telling Matt the story and he's pointing, and Quesada draws in shadow on the side of the bridge, like almost in a faded in flashback of sorts, while also retaining the modern, the current day imagery. You see Gwen falling, and it's almost like that's what Peter is seeing in his head as he's telling the story. And it was an amazing scene. It made me, like, the few scenes that Spider-Man was in this book made me wonder why Kevin Smith never wrote Spider-Man. Like, he had a handle on that voice, dude. It was amazing to me.
Yeah, it was my favorite issue of the series, and built off of what I thought was impossible to top in the issue immediately before it, issue six, I'm sorry, it was the one before, because issue seven was where we get the big reveal of the villain and the whole shebang. Issue six and then issue eight, I thought it was going to be impossible to top, but the last issue, number eight, did it. It topped it with that Spider-Man scene, which was the best cameo of the entire story. Another great conversation between Matt and Natasha.
Yep.
Another great conversation between Matt and Foggy that was just heartbreaking. The scene where Foggy's in prison and a flashback scene where he gets visited by Liz in prison. Just an amazing. And it would have been so easy, and I was expecting it to end on a somber note.
Right.
And it doesn't.
Nope.
And it was uplifting, and it left – it was just so character appropriate for everyone because Spider-Man introduces that spark of hope into the story that has been one of the darkest and most depressing stories. And then there's that little bit of hope that's thrown in there by Spider-Man, and it turns the whole ending around, and it ends on a positive note.
It's not, but it's the spark that Spider-Man provides, but then Matt is actually, in two flashbacks, remembers two different, very important conversations he had had with Karen at points in his life, and it's almost like Spider-Man had the spark, and those memories fanned that flame into this new finding the will to go on that Matt is able to find.
And also the very, very good mirror of the beginning of this story when he goes into the confessional.
Yep.
And he's confessing to the priest that he can't remember what it was like to feel that faith that he had when he was a kid. And at the very end, he tells the priest – the priest asks him how he feels, and he says, I feel like I'm remembering something that I forgot a long time ago. And – or I felt like I finally remember something that I forgot a long time ago. And it's just a great arc, a great story, and the perfect wrap-up to the story because there were times in the beginning when I was like, oh, this is kind of shaky. It's not going to work out. If they had limited this to a five-issue story arc, it wouldn't have worked. They needed the 8 issues, and it paid off.
Absolutely, in a huge way. So,
what did you make of the art of Joe Quesada while we're talking about it? Because this was probably some of your first exposure.
Yeah. I had seen images from Sword of Azrael, but never read it. You know, I really liked it. It's very much like you said in that image, early 90s style, where it's a little cartoonish. And probably a little more cartoonish than I was expecting, given the very dark story they were telling. But ultimately, especially in the action scenes, I wound up really, really liking it. And I want to give a shout out to, I believe it was Paul Miotti who did the covers, I think. But those images on the covers, there are certain things in comics that I am a sucker for. In terms of imagery, no matter how unrealistic they may be. For an example, long bat ears, love them. I have always loved them. Tim Sale style bat ears, I love, even though from a practical standpoint, they make no sense. With Daredevil, I love those images that you get of Daredevil's cane when, like, it is just the cable is wrapping out and, like, reaching out to such an insane degree that it makes absolutely no sense how you would fit, like, 200 feet of cable into the freaking cane. But there are some great covers and some great images of just Daredevil leaping in the air and like the cable from his cane just wrapping throughout the entire image that I love for whatever reason. So I wanted to give a shout out to those covers specifically.
Yeah. Really, I agree. His style is, you know, one of those styles that I think of from the 90s, but unlike a lot of people, I don't think that is a bad thing. I think that honestly a lot of today's artists could learn a lot from those guys in terms of action in particular.
Yes.
Because what they may have lacked at times in maybe facial expression details, things like that, they knew how to draw action scenes. And that is certainly true in this story because Joe Quesada knows how to draw an action scene. And I thought when he needed to, there were some scenes where I thought the faces looked a little weird, particularly Karen Page's face.
Yes.
But when they needed to, when he needed to show the faces having really emotional moments, he delivered big time, particularly in those last few
issues. One other thing I want to call about you know, the faces he did, I don't think I've ever seen a Daredevil story that shows you Matt's eyes as much as this one does.
Yeah, because he's always wearing glasses.
This one shows you Matt's eyes, like, as they are, as an actual person who would have had an accident like that would appear. You know, his eyes are glassed over, and it's almost off-putting at times. But eventually, once you become accustomed to seeing them, by the time the end of the book rolls around and you're seeing him, it is so difficult to convey emotion without being able to use the pupils of someone's eyes. And yet, through sheer muscle movement in the face, Quesada conveys the emotion of Matt Murdock better than anybody, you know, that I've seen in a long time who have the benefit of using eye pupils or whatnot. So it was just amazing work, I thought, in the facial department.
By the way, the Daredevil issue, I just looked it up online. The Daredevil issue I referenced earlier, the Frank Miller issue, I was correct. It's Daredevil number 191, and it was an issue called Roulette. And the entire issue is Daredevil sitting at Bullseye's hospital bed with a handgun playing Russian roulette with him. And contemplating whether to kill himself or to kill Bullseye. So, anyway, great reference, great pull by Kevin Smith for this story.
Absolutely.
Take it over, Nick.
No, you go ahead.
I was just going to say, when we kind of summarize this story, we've talked already about a lot of the great things about it. Were there any things that gave you pause about it? For me, for instance, I mentioned the pacing. I also wanted to say I am really glad that they did the flashback scenes in the last issue in particular, the Karen and Matt flashback scenes.
Yes.
Because I thought they were necessary, because the one thing that I thought, even to the point that she died, was – man, the women in this story, and Karen in particular, have not been written in a very flattering light.
Right, and that's part of the struggle with the character of Karen Page at that point is, you know, you were trying – it's hard for the audience to forgive her for a lot of the things she had, you know, been portrayed as doing at that point. So, yeah, those scenes I thought were very effective in terms of establishing just why Matt loved her so much and why
– yeah.
Ultimately, she was a good person. So I agree. Yeah. I would say the one thing, and they wound up fixing it, you know, at a certain point in the book, but I was very worried at first that it was going to be a supernatural-based Daredevil story. And had it actually gone down that road, I don't think it would have been nearly as effective as what we got. So I'll say those early issues, some of the supernatural stuff didn't work for me at first. But with the benefit of hindsight and finding out what the deal actually is, that whole storyline winds up working out in a big, big way for me.
Right. And I didn't, you know, I didn't like the way that Karen was written in the first half of the story and, you know, how selfish she was written. But they redeemed it at the end with the flashback sequences. So, again, those – I cannot say enough about those last 3-4 issues.
Yeah. Amazing stuff. So in total, I mean, in the full sum of things, I think we're both giving it 2 big thumbs up, correct?
Right, absolutely. Yeah.
I would certainly recommend this to anyone who is a fan of comics in general, whether you are a Daredevil fan or not. I mean, like I said, I haven't read much Daredevil. I can't proclaim to be a massive fan of the character, but this is just great comic storytelling all around, from the writing, the panel layouts, the art, the ink. I mean, just the lettering even was really, like, it takes a lot for me to sit up and notice the lettering of it.
The lettering, yeah.
But the lettering of this book, the way it transitions between word, you know, between dialogue bubbles to interior monologue to excerpts of written letters to parables from, you know, this biblical story that Matt's mother tells him, in which, you know, the lettering is written in Old English at that point. Just outstanding lettering. Everything about this book was just a phenomenal presentation from top to bottom.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It was outstanding. And I recommend it very highly, with a caveat. This is not something where you can give it one issue, because if you give it one issue, you'll probably think, wow, that was overrated. You know, no way I'm reading the rest of this. You have to read this as a trade.
Yes.
because it's written that way. The first issue is the weakest, I think.
Well, the first issue is so concerned with expository dialogue, with trying to get the new reader caught up to what the status quo of Matt Murdock and Karen Page and all these other characters is that it takes it a long time to actually get into the plot of what is happening.
Right. And so you have to really – but it does come into play thematically later in the story. So you need it. So this story really works best as a long book, which is appropriate for our topic of discussion. You really do need to take a long book hunt and read this whole thing and don't expect to breeze through it, because not all great books are fast reads, and this is not a fast read. It's not like necessarily – I wouldn't compare it to Watchmen in any way, because you know that's just a totally different animal in terms of the prose and all that stuff. But it's one of the slower moving good superhero stories you'll read, but man, is it rewarding when you get through it. It's a great, great character journey and another outstanding addition to Daredevil's history. I mean, what can you say about – all the great creative runs that they've had on this character.
It really makes me want to, you know, catch up on some Daredevil through Marvel Unlimited, because most of my Daredevil exposure is a couple of issues of, you know, a couple of story arcs of Bendis Daredevil. You know, obviously this Kevin Smith Daredevil, a few issues of the current Charles Soule run.
And we reviewed Brubaker.
Brubaker, yes, we did that one. And then also, I've actually read some of the 60s and 70s Stan Lee Daredevil, and I will say that even like the Silver Age Daredevil is better than most of the other Silver Age comics I've read from that time. Like, it just had a different feel to it and a different approach, and it feels like it tried things that you would not have seen in most Silver Age comics at that point. So, like I said, to this day, I've never read a bad Daredevil story, even, and that is to include the Silver Age ones, which is saying something. So yeah.
What do you mean by that, true believer?
Well, you know. Nothing, sir. But yeah, so I think I'm going to probably try to catch up on some Daredevil at some point through Marvel Unlimited in my you know, abundance of free time.
And just for your information, all of the stuff that was done here was directly continued as this Marvel Knights series continued with the run by David Mack as the writer.
Yes.
Which is still drawing.
And then Mack leads right into Bendis, I believe. Yes.
Yes, who then led right into Brubaker.
And then Bendis and Mack left Daredevil to work on Alias together.
Yep. So, yeah. So, yeah, just a great book. Check it out. And with that, we come to the end of this long book hunt and long-winded long book hunt. But we had a lot to say about this one. And we hope that you enjoy the show. And we hope that you come back in the coming weeks, because we've got a litany of hopefully interesting topics to discuss for your listening pleasure. Nick, what are some of the things we got coming up for the good folks?
Well, next week we'll be back with a new edition of Countdown. Countdown, that is, not Top 5. It's called Countdown, in which we'll be counting down the top 5 Marvel video games of all time. And we are currently slated to be joined by the Marvel expert himself, Marvel something or the other official title, big wig in charge, Ben Morse, who oversees Marvel.com. He is coming to guest with us next week. After that, we have got we're going to be going giant size, and we will be presenting to you the second biennial Peter David Memorial Place to Be Nation Pop Fantasy Comics Draft, presented by a hypothetical DC Comics online unlimited subscription service.
That's right. And then if you can survive that, and that's a big if, we'll get right into Walking Dead month in the month of October. Guests lined up to join us include Joseph Lee, Jennifer Smith, and maybe a few others if we get a wild hair about us. That'll take us through the month of October, looking at the books, the TV show, the phenomenon that is The Walking Dead. And then in November, we're going to come back with the second edition of Hard Travelers for Hire. Already getting good feedback on that one. Appreciate that. And we will be joined for our next one, a look at the Incredible Hulk movie by Russell Sellers of Sellers Point Podcasts. And by the way, you really should listen to the show in all seriousness.
Yeah.
We have fun at each other's expense, but check it out. It's awesome. Kelly's a good dude. Russell's a good dude. And Russell will be our guest next month in November as we look at the often forgotten, I feel like, Incredible Hulk movie. So we've got a lot of stuff coming up. We've got our hard traveling plans out for the next long while. So we're not going to run short on content for you.
That's right. We actually have a long term plan, which is unusual for us. So hopefully we'll be able to stick to it. But you know, with all that being said, we always welcome your feedback. Let us know if you've read Guardian Devil, or if you haven't. If our review has piqued your interest, or you know, if you have read it, let us know your opinions on it. And of course, you can always discuss any of the topics we covered in the rundown. You can discuss any of the books you're reading or shows you're watching right now. You can discuss your feelings on Diet Coke. You can discuss any number of things over at the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page, where we have a lot of good discussion, so be sure to check that out. Or, you know, hit Greg and I up on Twitter. I'm at NickDuke87. He is at GPhillips8652. You can send us emails via Greg P and Nick D, respectively, at placetobenation.com. No end to the number of ways to get in touch with us. And as we said last week, you know, Hard Travelers for Hire stems entirely based on user feedback. So give us feedback. We will listen to it if we feel like it. We always are looking for more feedback.
Absolutely. And if you have a book that you want us to review for the Long Book Hunters, I can't imagine why you would do this, but if you wanted to send us a book,
Yeah. Contact
us through the Facebook page or Twitter, and hell, we'll gladly take it. I mean, we can't necessarily buy whatever book that you suggest, but if you want to help us out and lend us a book for a while to read, we'll do it. If you want to give us a digital code, we'll do it.
Or if you wanted to just give us, like, for example, I don't know, a copy of the Alias Omnibus that currently sells for about $250 online. If you just wanted to give us one of those,
right,
we would gladly accept that as well.
Right. Or if you, if you have any copies of, as mentioned in Russell's podcast, The Walking Dead number one that you just don't want to have around the house anymore.
Yeah, we'll be glad to take those off your hands.
Off your hands, exactly.
Or if you'd like to buy some early 90s Image comics, feel free to reach out to yours truly. We can probably work something out.
And since Nick has been trying to sell his early 90s Image comics for weeks now, months now even, I am going to introduce the concept that I haven't listed it yet, but be on the lookout on eBay in the near future.
Don't do it. Don't do it.
I may.
You will eventually regret it, and I promise you that.
Well, there is a book in my collection that we have reviewed before on when we were doing columns, and it is the Infinite Crisis Omnibus. It is currently out of print. It is the way to read this story, ladies and gentlemen. It is my favorite crossover event of all time. It is compiled in a manner that is better than any compilation of a crossover event I've ever seen, but it's so rare that it's going for upwards of $400 on eBay. So I may, and I bought it for like $80, so I may end up selling it. But Nick's trying to be the angel on my shoulder talking me out of it, because he's probably right. I'll probably live to regret it if I do.
Absolutely. So with all that being said, we hope you've enjoyed this episode. Be sure to be back with us next week, as we are, of course, once again, to remind you, we are the longest running weekly
episodic
comic book
podcast in place to be nation pop history.
Indeed.
Yes. So with all that being said, folks, we'll catch you around the bend next time. And just remember, in the immortal words of the American Dream, Dusty Rhodes, doo-doo is good for me and it's good for you.
I was walking down a dirt road. Coming on fast, I had gone to borrow some cornmeal for our supper. By the time I got to Miss Johnson's house, I knew there was something wrong. By the worried look she had up on her face,
Miss Johnson, could you tell me, what are you seeking for? She said, Lord, they caught the devil and they got him in jail in Eudora, Arkansas. And he's got wings that look like leather and a long and forky tail. And when he touches it against the sailboards, sparks would fly. Soles off my feet on the way back home. Well, the next day a crowd had gathered out in front of a Eudora jailhouse, but there was not a trace to be seen of the devil. Now the jailer had been a poor man, but now his pockets were stuffed with money. And he was sitting outside in a brand new Continental Lincoln. With Fender skirts on it. He would not say where he got the money. Was he a part of the devil's bargain?